And today we're going to be talking about generalization of the idea of
not only talking about today, I summarized the article on the archive. And I want to start by saying that these ideas started actually when I was working in the last of this textbook in international ministry. Alright, and by the way, this is not a pentagram, I'm going to start by telling you about classical theories and how properties are represented in classical theories, and then I'm going to work out to tell you what a non-contextual invariable theory of quantum mechanics looks like. So if you're doing a classical theory, then you associate properties with regions of statements. Let me give you an example of what I mean. Suppose you just have a particle in one dimension. Your state space is just space, position of momentum. And if you want to talk about the property of having energy between values E1 and E2, for instance, then that corresponds to this elliptical ring in space space. Another example would be sort of a more abstract kind of property, which is just trying to have some value A1 if x is less than x1, A2 between x1 and x2, and A3 if it's larger than x2. That's another example of an attribute I might be interested in. And the only thing that's really important about this function is what these regions are. So I can represent this function of the state space as a sum of these values, A1, A2, A3, and characteristic functions, which I denote by I sub k, which are just functions that are 1 in the region associated with the property and 0 elsewhere. So these three characteristic functions actually tell me all I need to know about this particular attribute. In fact, if I want to talk about probability of getting any one of these three outcomes in a measurement of this attribute, then all I need to know are what these characteristic functions are. Because if initially I don't know exactly what the state of the system is, I don't know exactly what point x, comma, p the system corresponds to, and I just have some ugly distribution over that space, then I can still calculate the probability of getting outcome k as just the probability assigned to the point x, p times the characteristic function x. So for all those values of x and p where this is 1, I get a contribution to probability. And so this will give me the total probability of finding, say, outcome 2. It's just that slice of this distribution integrated up. So it turns out that only the characteristic functions are important here. And there's an analog of that in quantum theory. Quantum theory, we often talk about Hermitian operators as representing attributes of observables. But I can decompose any Hermitian operator according to spectral resolution. So these are the projectors that appear in spectral resolution, give the eigenvalues. And if I ask what's the probability of finding their eigenvalue in measurement of that operator, it turns out, if the initial state is psi, for instance, it turns out the probability is completely determined by just these projectors. So I don't actually need these eigenvalues, they're just a way of labeling the different outcomes. But what's important for capturing the probabilities of these outcomes are just the projectors. So for that reason, quantum information theorists have taken to representing measurements by just the sets of projectors. They're called projector value measures. And that's the kind of approach that I'm going to take here. And that's analogous to representing your classical observables with just the sets of characteristic functions by the arbitrary value functions. So, what's the idea of a deterministic invariable theory? It's basically to say that for every state in the Hilbert space, you associate a distribution over some lambda, some set of invariables. And for every observable, relation operator, you have some functional variables, or equivalently, for every set of projectors, or projected value vectors, you have some set characteristic functions. So that's the idea. You want to represent states and measurements in these ways, and you hope to reproduce on statistics. But now, here's the subtlety. There it turns out there are many ways of measuring a given projected value measure. Here's an example. If I just have an observable that has two eigenspaces, one is the projector onto psi 1, the other is the rest of the space. So here's the ray psi 1, here's the 2D space, that's the bottom of it. Then I can measure that in two different ways, at least two of which I've indicated here. So the first way is I measure actually the bases psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, and then I just ignore whether I got the two or three other ones, like coarse grain here. So now it's just a two output measurement corresponding to this ray and this space. But I could have measured some other bases, psi 2 prime, psi 3 prime, and coarse grain them to be equivalent. So you might hope that the way you're going to represent this sort of ambiguity in the hidden variable theory is as follows. With this sort of measurement of this basis, you divide up your hidden variable space into three regions. These are the characteristic functions, chi 1, chi 2, chi 3. And this other measurement is also a division into three regions. And the first region is actually the same as in this case. So chi 1 is exactly the same here. And chi 2 prime and chi 3 prime are different from chi 2 and chi 3. So the idea is that if I coarse grain in the hidden variable theory these two characteristic functions for these two, I get exactly the same thing. So it doesn't matter how I further resolve this outcome into two possibilities. It's just a further division of the hidden variable space into regions. So that seems like a reasonable approach. And this is actually the traditional notion of non-contextuality, which I can state as follows. For every projector P, which will correspond to some measurement outcome, you associate a single characteristic function. And it's the same characteristic function regardless of how you measure P. Whether it's in this context or this context, same characteristic function. Yes, that should be straight. And here. kind of proper. So is that clear? Yes?
So is there a possibility of you can design a measurement that would only measure the orthogonal subspace as such without splitting your bottom?
That's right. So you could say that's a third context anyway. So there's three ways of measuring. But there are many more. But yeah, you're right. That's another way of measuring. All right. So just to show you that this isn't that foolish, I'm going to give you a simple hidden variable theory for a spin and half system. So two-dimensional. So I'm going to imagine these. So the possible state vectors are just pointing up along some direction instead of the x up. And I'm going to represent those in the hidden variable theory by distributions over some hidden variable, which I denote by a u vector. That hidden variable now is just going to be some direction on the sphere. What you might have expected to be the hidden variable for a spin half system, some direction on the sphere. And the distribution that's associated with this vector is one that looks like this. It's non-zero in one hemisphere, the hemisphere that's pointing in the same direction as n hat. And it has a cosine distribution, right? So if n hat is pointing along z up, for instance, then it's just a cosine distribution centered around that point. So n hat, so if I have a z up spin, and I represent that in the hidden variable theory by this sort of distribution of hidden variables. So fall off. High probability of finding the hidden variable here, zero probability of finding it in the bottom hemisphere. And then measurements are represented by a characteristic function of this one. So if I do a measurement spin along direction m, then that corresponds to just asking, is it in the hemisphere that's oriented along m or not? So it divides the sphere, and it just asks, is the actual state in this hemisphere or not? So the characteristic function is 1 in this hemisphere, 0 in the other. So basically, all I do is if I want to know when I prepare it, set up, I do a measure to them, what's the probability of getting the outcome? Yes. I just integrate the probability in this one screen. And when you do that, you find this result, half 1 plus the inner product between m and n. And that's exactly the inner product squared between those two states. So it's exactly the quantum probability of getting the yes outcome you're measuring with m given the current variation of n. So this hidden variable theory does exactly what we want. It reproduces the quantum statistics in terms of this underlying hidden variable explanation. This actually is in a 1967 paper by Hawking and Specker. I think it's actually a much nicer hidden variable theory than others you'll find of this sort, like from the paper with Bell, the Bell has a state vector as another hidden variable. The state vector doesn't appear. So in Bell's paper, there's two vectors. There's a hidden variable with two vectors, a u and a psi. So, given that success, you might have thought that, well, we can do this for all quantum mechanics, but you can't. So, in 1966, Bell showed, and Hawking Specter showed independently, in different paper, that if you want to get a variable model of that sort, non-contextual, you can't have it for other spaces of dimensionality 3 or greater. So another way of saying that you can't have a non-contextual variable model is to say that quantum theory is contextual. How you represent a projector depends on how you're measuring it. So if you're fine grading one way or another way, you'll have to represent that same projector differently, depending on the context. I'll go into more detail on these ideas later. So this is called the Bell-Hawking-Specter theorem. And typically these theorems are actually quite complicated. One of the simplest ones actually uses a set of vectors in space that correspond to all the points in this object, actually this particle diagram, which is kind of cool. And what's also relevant about this diagram is that the proofs, what they basically tell you, if you have these tripods, as I was saying, that are line up along one axis but are different for the other two axes, I could always make my characteristic functions agree locally for any two of those tripods. But the way the proofs work is you take a whole bunch of tripods and you add them together, and you come back to the first one, and you can always get local agreements, but you can, when you get back to the first one, you get a contradiction. So you can't get global agreement. And that's kind of what's going on here. Locally, if you look at this picture, it looks fine, it looks like a valid three-dimensional object, but when you look at it globally, it's not possible. Yes. In two dimensions, there's really only one way to measure. So if you don't have that sort of ambiguity, every non-trivial measurement doesn't have any fine grains.
Is that basically why it's possible?
Yeah. Well, there is a notion of context, but so for instance, I'll get to an example of different contexts for measurements in a two-dimensional Hilbert space. And those contexts don't have different representations of the form and form. Whether I use a piece of Polaroid or a calcite crystal to measure photon polarization, as an example of the context, you can't derive an over theorem. But I am going to talk about how there are notions of context different from this fine grading notion. And from those other sorts of contexts that can be represented more formally, I can derive no-go theorems even in 2D. So this restriction to three dimensions, by the end of the talk, we'll see how you can actually come up with catch up because there are restrictions out there. Okay, so what's wrong with this traditional notion of non-contextuality for contextuality? First of all, it only applies to quantum theory. The way it's stated in all the textbooks is specific to quantum theory. I'd like to generalize it to apply to any operational theory. I'll tell you what I mean by an operational theory in a moment. Secondly, the traditional notion only applied to sharp measurements, that is, Hermitian operators or projective value measurements. And there's a more general notion of measurement, positive operator value measurement, unsharp. and it'd be nice if we generalize to that case. But it'd also be nice if it applied to preparation procedures and transformation procedures. And finally, it only applied to deterministic invariable theories. And it would be nice if we could talk about any realist interpretation, even if there are no hidden variables, so all those things on the logical models, and even if they're stochastic. So what I'd like to do is propose a new definition, and first half of the talk I'm going to make this clear. A non-contextual ontological model of an operational theory is one wherein if two experimental procedures are operationally equivalent, then they have equivalent representations in the ontological model. So the idea is that I've got two procedures, maybe they're different in their details, maybe they differ in their context, but there's a sense in which they're equivalent in respect of statistics of outcomes, what I can see in the lab. And if so, then I want them to be represented the same way in my ontological model. That's the idea. But not for all possible preparations. So I'll get this my very next slide again and tell you what I mean by equivalent. So that was just a very vague, not even very specific about all those things. So first let me say what do I mean by operational theory? So it's a very unambitious theory. Basically, it says primitive elements of my theory are just going to be things you do in the lab. So you have preparation procedures, the boxes, the knob, you press a button, start going. You have transformation procedures, also there's some knob that can change what you're doing. And you have measure procedures, some knob and then some pointer that gives you a reading. So this could be an oven that puts out silver atoms, and this could be a magnetic field that rotates and spins, and then this could be a string or like that measurement. And the point is that I want to make these things the primitives of my theory. So these are just lists of instructions. So when I say, what's a particular preparation procedure? What do I mean by this notation E? It's a long list of things to do in the lab. You know, go build an oven, open the aperture, and, you know, wait a second, something like that. So these things are just going to denote lists of things you do in the lab. And the purpose of an operational theory is to basically provide an algorithm for predicting the probabilities of different outcomes in this measurement, given certain preparations, transformations, and measurement procedures. And that's it. There's no talk about atoms or microscopic systems or space and time or anything like that. It's just, if I do this in the lab, then this is what I should expect. What's nice about that is that it's a very interpretation-neutral way of formulating it. You can take any theory and cast it as an operational theory. So what's the bare minimum that this theory tells me about what's going to happen in the world? So now, given that notion of an operational theory, I can define what I mean by operational equivalence. So here it is. Let's say you've got some large set of preparation procedures and measurement procedures that you're considering. Now, these two preparation procedures could differ in their details. You know, in one of them, I buy my oven for silver atoms from one manufacturer, and the other I bought it from a different manufacturer. You know, one is painted red, and the other is painted blue. These are sort of inconsequential differences. And so what I expect is that if I figure out what the probabilities of different outcomes of measurement M are for one and the other procedure, I'll get the same probability. It doesn't matter what color the oven was painted, I'll get the same statistics when I do a measurement. And if I take all the measurements that I'm going to consider, and I do every one of them, and I calculate statistics, and I find that these two preparation procedures give me the same statistics of outcomes no matter what measurement I do, then I say, well, look, from the perspective of all the measurements, these things are equivalent. It doesn't matter which one of them I use, I'm going to get the same statistics. So changing the color of the oven should be an example of a case where I'm going to get the same statistics regardless. Yes. I think it is a problem if you really want to pursue this idea of an operational theory as a way of interpreting quantum mechanics, for instance, just stopping there. All we need to do in science is come up with an operational theory. Then I think you have a difficult problem saying, well, you know, what is a natural set of measurements considered? Because I think here really we're making use of the notion of the system. I mean, really what I have in mind is, let's say I'm talking about a spin-out particle, then I consider all the ways of preparing that spin-out particle, all the ways of measuring it, all the ways of transforming it, and I figure out, like, what's the process for that. But I mean, if you bang on the table and I have a string Gerlach experiment set up, it shouldn't affect statistics, so I can say, aha, this preparation procedure without Anthony banging on the table, and the same preparation procedure if you bang on the table for operational equivalent. So then I can sort of figure out if that's not relevant. But the question becomes, at some point I have to say, here's the only set of measurements I'm interested in. Right, exactly, yeah. You might measure the color of your oven, and obviously those two preparations are different.
I think B, that once I produce a problem that produces electrons, and the other gives you a phenomenon that produces fuel. And then I never thought of the propagation of the thing.
And so with respect to that set of measurements, those two preparation procedures will be operationally equivalent. And I won't be, as long as I stick to that set of measurement procedures, any inferences I make based on that fact won't be mistaken.
There's no way to change for quantum never confused.
No, I'm sort of imagining that it's some fixed set that you're interested
in. It might be true with respect to one set and
right, exactly.
That's right. I mean, if you're instead of for all M, some set M?
Sure. Some set. Yeah, or for all M in the set that you're interested in. So later, what I'm going to be using are things like all the measurements you might want to do on a spin-out part. So all the measurements that quantum theory says can be done. That's where I'm going with this. So that's the notion of equivalence for preparations. You get a similar notion for measurements. If I take two measurement devices, and for all possible preparation procedures, their statistics are exactly the same, then they're equivalent measurements. And then similarly, if I throw a transformation procedure between a preparation and a measurement, then two transformations are equivalent if I get the same statistics for all preparations and for all measurements. Okay. So here's the picture we have. You've got this big set of procedures. And then you can now sort them into equivalence classes, right? So at every point in here is a different procedure, different list of instructions of what to do in the lab. And now I can say, look, these two here, they're operationally equivalent. They give me the same sort of statistics, and everything in this set is equivalent, and so forth. Yes? No, here I'm just being, this is sort of general, so this is going to be the set of all preparations, or the set of all measurements, or the set of all transformations. Yeah, that's right. So I'm starting with just sort of a total set for each, and then I'm evaluating equivalence of one relative to those sets. Oh, because just the transformation procedure can only be thought of, like, incorporated into preparation or incorporated into measurement. Just expand. So again, kind of sort of judging the equivalence of two preparation procedures. If I say for all M and for all T, well, I can just take every couple, T and M, to be a different kind of measurement. So it's just a technicality. So the different points in some of these equivalence classes are what I'm going to mean by different contexts. Okay, so this is now my definition of a context. It's where you are in a equivalence class. So if you give me a list of things to do in a lab, then I can tell you exactly which procedure it is by telling you what equivalence class it falls into and the context, i.e. where it is in my equivalence class. So here's an example from quantum theory. So suppose I want to measure the polarization, whether a photon is vertically or horizontally polarized. Well, I can go to the store and buy a piece of Polaroid that only, and I can orient it so that it only passes vertical polarization, and then I do detection. So that's one measurement procedure. You know, orient it vertically and look for detection. Or I can take a calcite crystal, which bends like differently depending on whether it's vertically or horizontally polarized, by aligning it properly. And so the vertical light comes out one way, and the horizontally polarized light comes out another way, and I can detect here. And again, if I get a detection, that tells me that it was vertically polarized. So with respect to all preparation procedures, these two things look equivalent. I get the same statistics about outcomes. Now, I consider another pair of preparation of measurement procedures, which measure for horizontal polarization. So I just align my piece of polarized along this axis instead, or I flip my calcite crystal upside down, and I look at things coming out of the upper beam. And these two are also equivalent operationally. I get the same statistics no matter how I prepare the light ahead of time. So these are examples. These two procedures are in the same equivalent spots. These two procedures are in a different equivalent spots. And these are just different contexts for doing these measurements. All right. Good. Now, to make clear what my definition of non-contextuality was, I have to be a bit more explicit about what I mean by an ontological model. So this is my generalization of an invariable situation. So it's pretty much the same as what I was talking about before. For preparation procedures, the way I want to represent them is now as distributions over some set of invariables. So there's really going to be an invariable. But when I do something in the lab, what it means is that I have strict knowledge about what the value of that invariable is. So I might know that it's constrained to this region, and it's more likely to be here than there, and it's, my knowledge is characterized by some distribution. Now, my measurements are going to be a bit more general than what I considered before. Previously, I considered measurements to be partitionings of the hidden variable space into separate regions. So measurements were just asking, is the hidden variable in this region, or this region, or this region? But something more general could occur, which is that the outcome of the measurement actually is not deterministic, even if you give me the value of the hidden variable. So here's an example of a set of what I call indicator functions that can represent a measurement. So if the hidden variable has this value over here, then definitely I'll get outcome 1. But if it has a value in this region, then probably a half I'll get outcome 2, and probably a half I'll get outcome 3. So what I require is that these three functions have to sum to 1, so that at every value of the hidden variable, some outcome will occur. But they can have any shape I like. So this is a generalization of deterministic hidden variable theory, because it allows that even if you tell me everything there is to know about the state of the system, it might be that the outcome of the measurement still is not determined. All right. And then finally, I'm going to represent transformations as basically transition matrices. Yes?
So the idea was that if you only do very close, then you could tell.
Well, I would say you might have that response, but I would say there are some measurements in quantum theory for which you might expect that the outcome should still be random, even if you specify everything there's to know about the system. So, for instance, there are certain kinds of measurements in quantum theory that actually their outcome depends on each of the apparatus. So if it's noisy, for instance, so I'm trying to do a measurement of Z-spin, but in fact, it's sort of a noisy measurement. So it doesn't always reveal what the actual spin was. So what it's really doing is it's generating some random numbers somewhere in the apparatus, and that's influencing the outcome. Now, if I want to take that into account in the hidden variable theory, I need to be able to say that sometimes the state of the system is not enough to tell me exactly what the outcome will be. So this sort of generalization will allow me to take into account error correction measurements, for instance. And that's basically what I'm going to use it for.
But we can also do some improvement in the
normal So it's true that one motivation for hidden variable theories was to say, could it be that all the probabilities we see in ideal quantum measurements might be due to lack of knowledge? That's one motivation. But another motivation is just, can we think of systems as having different properties and the measurements revealing those properties? And you might say, maybe I'm willing to grant that the universe is fundamentally stochastic in some way, so that measurements don't always have deterministic outcomes.
So it's either pretty good, these two levels of invariable theories, once the way you say that actually determine this state. Right? And the thing is, what is extra-topics actually going to pass on that? And then median level, the region random mechanics is a structural limitation. And that strict in the UV1 where state demand to fix to a certain degree, but at least you have to discuss everything in terms of probability rather than to react.
Yes. You might feel like this is just working for a while and what a stochastic variable theory is. The reason I don't use the term being variable theory, but use the ontological law instead is that this includes the possibility that the state of a physical system is just its quantum state. So the states of reality are mapped one-to-one to the quantum state, in which case nothing is hidden. There are no extra variables. But I would still call that an ontological model. So it's one wherein all the distributions are delta functions, and the space of the variables is just projected delta space, and so on. But that's really a technicality, so I can incorporate those sorts of ideas within this thing. Okay. So the idea, of course, is you want to reproduce the predictions of your operational theory in this ontological model by saying that, all right, here are the probabilities for the value d lambda. Here's the probability that lambda becomes lambda prime under the transformation. Here's my indicator function over lambda prime. I integrate. That should give me the probability of getting outcome k. So if I have this kind of model and reproduce the statistics, I've done it. I've got an ontological model of my operational theory. So I'm imagining a system that actually comes out of the preparation procedure, comes out of the preparation device, passes through the transformation device, gets measured. Lambda describes all the possible states of that system in the ontological model.
So the effective lambda is how you measure the system.
Lambda, so the space of lambda, the space of invariables, is always the same. So I can say I've got to spend my part, but the space of escapes is always the same. When I do a preparation, and I know exactly what I've done, I say, okay, well now I know that lambda is in this region with each relative weights. So I represent the preparation procedure as gaining information about what the value of lambda is. And then I represent the transformation as being a disturbance to the value. For this value of lambda, and I can move off to other values with certain probabilities and so on. And so I can take this, my knowledge, I can take it through this map and get a new distribution. And then I subject that to, like, multiply it by these functions to figure out what the probability of those three outcomes are measured.
Why couldn't there be a little variance to say where you get lambda through the increments as well?
Here I'm really exploring the idea that you could explain the quantum predictions or the predictions of any operational theory just in terms of the state of the system. The dependence on the apparatus is included to some extent, because if the outcome of my measurement depends on, say, a dice that was rolled inside the apparatus, then I can incorporate that here by just saying, if you tell me the state of the system, I still have probability a half and a half for these two outcomes. So that could explain the presence, this could account for the presence of the dice in the apparatus.
That's the only thing I'm intending to do.
But here I'm really exploring the possibility of explaining things in terms of properties of the system. I'm not talking about properties.
This is probably the last question about the difference in your consumption of contextuality and outcome depends on something about the
measurement. Yeah, so the way I'm going to define contextuality, no. It's going to be, that's not going to be the case. I'll get into that. So here's the idea. So everything I told you just now was, what's an ontological model for operational theory? That says nothing about contextuality. What is a non-contextual ontological model? Well, if it's preparation ontological, it means that I don't have different distributions for all different preparation procedures. all the preparation procedures in one equivalence class are associated with the same distribution. Okay, so this just means the equivalence class. And all of the indicator functions in an equivalence class are represented, or sorry, all the measurements in the equivalence class are represented by the same set of indicator functions. And all the transformations in the equivalence class are represented by the same transition matrix. So that's the idea. You find out operationally which procedures are equivalent to one another, and then you demand that they be represented in exactly the same way in your ontological non-equality. That's the assumption of non-equality generalized to any procedure. So let me now apply that to quantum theory. The next few slides are a bit of a synopsis of how to think about quantum mechanics in an operational way. And maybe for people who aren't so familiar with the formalism of quantum information theory, these slides are meant for you. Others can go to sleep if you have stuff. So again, we have our preparations, transformations, measurements. Quantum theory, sort of textbook quantum theory, these things are associated with state vectors in Hilbert space, these with unitary maps, and these with Hermitian operators or equivalently sets of vectors. And the probability of getting outcome k in this measurement is just this expression here. I take psi, I evolve it into this unitary operator, and I find the expectation value of k. So that's pretty clear. But there are more general preparations than those. And so, for instance, if I pair the state psi with probability p, and I pair the state chi with probability q, and then I measure this EBM, what's the probability I'm going to get the outcome k? Well, here's the probability if I prepare the psi, and I weight that by p. Here's the probability if I prepare chi, I weight that by q. I can rewrite these things in terms of the trace formula, bring it all together using the linearity of the trace, and I can write it this way, trace rho pq, where rho is now a convex sum of these two projectors, and that's just the density operator. So the most general preparation, it turns out, is represented by a density operator. This is just one way of achieving a density operator. If your density operator is a projector onto some vector, then it's a pure preparation. If it's not, then we call it a mixed preparation. These mixed preparations are actually going to be critical in proving preparations in textuality. So the same thing can be said for transformations. There are more than just unitary transformations. If I do one of two unitaries with different probabilities, and I ask how can I represent that in formalism, it turns out it's represented by something called a completely positive map. I won't go into the details, but if your map is just as this form, if you thought of it as a unitary operation, then I call it a reversible transformation. If it doesn't have that form, then I call it an irreversible transformation. Again, this is just one way you can have an irreversible transformation. There are other ways, like actually coupling your system to some other system. And then finally, you can generalize measurements in much the same way by taking a convex combination of two measurements. And when you ask how to represent that, it turns out you need a positive operator value measure. So maybe I should go through this one in a bit more detail. So here's my probability for outcome k for these two measurements. I can rewrite it as just trace row ek, where ek is a convex sum of projectors ek and uk. And so this thing here is no longer a projector. Ek is, however, a positive operator. And if I sum over the k's, I get identity. So it turns out that that's good, because if the probability of outcome k is trace rho ek, then I want it to be that if I sum over the k's, I get 1. There has to be some outcome. And sure enough, if I sum over ek, I get identity, and trace rho is 1, so that works. Anyhow, I am going to be talking a bit about some very simple POVMs later on. And one other bit of notation, if the POVM is actually a projective value measure, so if all these guys are projectors, then it's a sharp measurement. And if they're not, then I call it unsharp. Okay, so traditional proofs of contextuality involve talk about sharp measurements and pure preparations. But in order to get proofs that work in 2D, you actually have to consider unsharp measurements and mixed preparations. So it's equivalent to say that k squared is ek, that's a sharp measurement. That's right. Yeah, that's just the definition of mixed preparations. All right, so here's the most general picture. In quantum theory, your preparation, every preparation has to be represented by some density operator. Every transformation is represented by some CP map. Every measurement is represented by some GOM. And the probability of getting out from K, if you tell me each of these, is just take rho, act on it with the CP map, multiply by your POVM element associated with outcome K, take the trace, that gives you the probability of getting outcome K. Alright, so this is basically the most general framework in which you can do quantum theory. Okay, just these sorts of questions. So, what are examples of contexts for preparations in quantum theory? So remember my diagram from before. Now let's make it specific. Let's assume these are all the preparations in quantum theory. Now the different equivalence classes of preparations are all represented by different density operators. As I just told you, and all the points within an equivalence class are different contexts for that density operator. And the assumption of non-connectionality for preparations is just that the distribution I associate with any one of these points depends only on the density operator. It depends only on which equivalence class it's in, and not where it is in that equivalence class. So, here's an example. Suppose I have a mixed preparation. So it's associated with some non-rank 1 density operator. It turns out that there are many sets of probabilities and state vectors such that if I sum the projectors onto those states with these probabilities, I get rho. So another way of saying this is that there are many convex decompositions of a given mixed state. A simple example is if you take completely unpolarized light, it can be thought of as a mixture of left and or horizontal and vertical polarization for probabilities, or left circular and right circular polarization. That's just different ways of decomposing a completely mixed state into a sum of pure states. So that's an example of a context, because I can go to the lab, I can compare vertical polarization with probability half, horizontal polarization with probability half, put that whole thing in a box, and or I can do the left or right circular, put it all in a box. And then I let you do as many measurements as you want, and you won't be able to tell those two boxes apart. You won't be able to see which of those two mixtures I made. So those are two different preparation procedures, but they're operationally equivalent. And so what I'm demanding is that the way they be represented in my hidden variable theory depend only on the density operators. It doesn't depend on whether it's, you know, equal mixture of horizontal vertical or equal mixture of left and right circular. All right, there are other kinds of context preparations. Another example is, you know, what maybe you prepare this mixed state by actually tracing out another system with which it was entangled, and then there are lots of ways of getting the same density operator by tracing over different entangled states. But this isn't going to be important for some measurement. Okay, so I can ask the same question about measurements. What kinds of context for measurements are there? Remember, different equivalence classes of measurement procedures are represented by different POVMs in the quantum formalism. Non-contextuality, the assumption that the way I represent the measurement depends only on the POVM. So you also have an ambiguity here in terms of convex decompositions. So it turns out that, let's say, so these are meant to be a set of POVMs labeled by J. So I have POVM 1, POVM 2, and I can roll the dice to decide whether to do this one or this one. And the whole thing could be represented by one POVM. But it could be that there's some other pair of POVMs here, and I roll a different dice, decide whether to do this one or this one, and in the end, I get a measurement procedure that's represented exactly the same way by the same POVM. So if I put this in the box, this in the box, I can't distinguish them. So I expect those things to be represented in the hidden variable theory in the same way. And then another notion of context, which will also be important, is different flying rate. So I mentioned this at the beginning of the talk. This is the traditional notion of non-contextuality, that if you have a projective value measure, there's lots of ways of breaking it up into pure states, for instance. A given projector onto a two-dimensional subspace, you broke it up into two pure states in lots of different ways. Similarly, you can generalize that to POVMs. There are some very fine-grained POVMs, like coarse-grained nouns. I take another fine-grained POVM that's different from the first and coarse-grained it, and I left the same thing. And then, again, there are other examples, like ways of complement analysis and so forth. The point is that there are lots of contexts. And then, setting accounts for transformations. I have different contexts in terms of convex decompositions. So, the way people say this in the quantum information literature is that there are many Krauss decompositions of a given CP map. It's basically, you know, some set of unitaries with some probabilities to give the same map as a different set of unitaries with a different set of anyways, you get the idea. I can also talk about entangling kinosis to influence the effect of the map on this. So there's all these different ways of having preparations, measurements, and transformations that are represented the same way in quantum forms. Okay, now I want to make use of those different contexts to actually show that a non-contextual ontological model isn't possible, even in a two-dimensional over space. So the easiest case is preparation of contextuality. So when I say I'm going to show you a proof of preparation of contextuality, what I mean is that a non-ontological model that's preparation non-contextual is impossible. Okay. You need to know a couple of facts about ontological models. These don't have anything to do with non-contextuality. Suppose that preparation P is represented by this distribution, P prime, by this one. And suppose that P and P prime are distinguishable preparations. So that means, you know, I have one box, which is P, another box, which is P prime. And there's a measurement you can do, a one-shot measurement, that tells you with certainty whether it was P or P prime. Okay, so for instance, you know, P could prepare Z up, P prime could prepare Z down. You just have to do a measurement of Z spin and you can retrofit certainly which those two was. In the hidden variable theory, or the ontological model, the distributions associated with these two preparation procedures have to be disjoint. They have to not overlap anything. And the reason is that if they did overlap somewhere, then when I prepare P, when I do the P procedure, I'm generating a system that can state lambda with this probability distribution. So it could be some of the time lambda is over here, because that has some weight. And when I do P prime, I'm generating a system with state lambda according to this probability distribution. So some of the time I have lambda here. And the point is that if lambda happens to end up here, there's no measurement I can do that will tell me which preparation procedure was done. Even if I had a measurement that completely resolved this lambda, told me exactly what the value was, it wouldn't be able to tell me whether it was prepared according to this distribution or this distribution. So there's no way, if these preparations are distinguishable, that they could be represented this way. They have to be represented this way. Okay, that's one fact. The second fact is that if I do a convex combination of preparation procedures, and by that I mean I have my procedure P, I flip my coin, my coin is such that the probability P comes out heads, probably 1 minus P comes out tails. I flip my coin. If it comes out heads, I do P. If it comes out tails, I do P prime. And I put that whole thing in a box, and I call that a double prime. That's a new procedure. How am I going to represent that in the invariable theory? Well, if P was represented by mu, and P prime was represented by mu prime, then I have to represent it this way. If I ask, what's the probability that lambda has this particular value? Well, if it was P, it's mu of lambda, I weight that by P. If P prime is mu prime, I weight that by 1 minus P. This is the probability I have to assign to that lambda. So does anyone disagree with these two things? Good. All right, so I'm going to use these two facts, plus assumption model. So here's the proof. It uses these six pure states of a two-dimensional system. So I've written them out explicitly.
Well, yes. I think it's a grid that it's a design of shocks and improve.
It's a what?
It's a design of shocks. It's a constraint that you put on your notepad in the direction. If you don't have to, for example, that simulation in this one, you might come up with a different way and then you can't fulfill that simulation.
But in the context of the theory that says measurements just reveal something about the state of the system, the value of lambda. And preparations nearly lead to a change in my knowledge about what that value of lambda is. In the context of that sort of approach, I claim that you have to adopt this assumption. There's no alternative. There's no other way to represent complex computations. There's no other way to represent state of preparations. Maybe there is a way here, but it's very bizarre. It's like saying, look, I have some device that generates a system with distribution mu of lambda. Okay. Now that it is, if I first flip a coin, should that change what this device does? It's possible that my action of flipping a coin before I do it could actually change what the shape of this distribution is. But that seems like a bizarre sort of assumption. So I guess I would agree with you. This is an additional assumption, but I think it's very safe.
When you say the probability of the means preparation, there are five definitions.
No, the definition of P was not something that generates this distribution, it was a list of instructions. It's go, get your own now, open the aperture, wait a second. That's what the definition of P was. So I can imagine flipping a coin and then getting my own and doing all those things. And it could still be an open question whether that should be represented.
But you find the real value of something that corresponds to P.
Yes.
So if I then talk about probability of the entry P, then you can talk about probability of the entry P.
Yeah, I agree. I think if you deny this assumption, then you have to sort of question the whole association of preparation, distribution, the whole thing.
I think everybody's probably throwing that off my extra instruction suite. If you need to know what it means, it's very nice.
Yeah, so I mean, maybe there's room for examining alternatives to this assumption. I don't see exactly where that sort of recent program would go. My perspective just seems reasonable. Okay, so out of proof work, I start with six pure states. It turns out the first two are orthogonal, the second two are orthogonal, so the third two represent my little a, big a, and so forth. If I draw these on a plane of the Bloch sphere, orthogonal states appear like antipodal points. So it turns out that this is like a Z spin up, this is spin up in a direction of 60 degrees, spin that up, and so forth. Those are the states I'm interested in. Now, just because I'm going to be talking about combinations, convex combinations, it's actually easy to work with density operators. I can just rewrite all those states in terms of their density operators. And then their orthogonality relations become just the product of two density operators. And now, here's the key, that we know from quantum theory that if I do the preparation associated with little a, or the preparation associated with big a, they're distinguishable in certainty. That's just the set up, set down example. I know there's a measurement that can tell those two apart. So that implies that the distributions associated with those preparations have to be disjoint. For the reasons I gave on the last slide. Otherwise, it would explain the fact that it's disjoint. And similarly, for little b, big b, little c, big c, they have to be associated with disjoint distributions as well. Okay. Now let me define five new preparation procedures. The first one is just going to be, flip a fair coin and decide whether to do little a or big A. Now put that whole thing in a box and call that P, little a, big A. And similarly for little b, big B, and little c, big C. And then another procedure will be roll a dice that, or generate a random number between 1 and 3 with equal probabilities. I decide whether to do little a, little b, or little c. Put that all in a box and call that p, little abc. And the same thing for p, big abc. Okay, so again, from our discussion on the last slide, given that this is just convex combination, the way these five procedures should be represented in the ontological model is just as convex sums of those distributions with the perfect weights. All right, so now I've got these two constraints on these distributions. There's one other fact that we have to take into account, which is that if you look at what the quantum formalism says about these five new preparation procedures, it turns out that a convex sum of z up and z down is exactly the same thing as a convex sum of up 60 degrees from Z and down 60 degrees from Z. So this and this, the a half each, actually takes me to the center of the block screen, the completely mixed state. And similarly, a convex sum of these two guys takes me to the completely mixed state. And if I take probability a third of each of these guys, I get the completely mixed state. All of these convex combinations give me the same thing in quantum theory. So what that means is that they're operationally equivalent. If I, you know, this is like the horizontal and vertical polarization with equal weights, and left and right super polarization with equal weights. Nothing I do can distinguish those cases. So if you consider these five different preparation procedures, they're all associated with the same density operator, nothing you measure can distinguish them. So this is where the assumption of preparation on actuality comes in. I'm telling you that these five procedures are operationally equivalent. What I mean by preparation on contextuality is any preparations that are equivalent should be represented in the same way in variable theory. So these should all be represented by exactly the same distribution. I'll just call that mu of lambda. Okay, so now I can replace the mu little a big a, mu little b big b, all those different mu's on the left-hand side with just one distribution all of here. Now, so I have two constraints now. This and my constraint of disjointness, right? So here are all the constraints I've been able to derive. And what I want to know is there some set of distributions, seven different distributions, that can actually satisfy all these constraints or not? And what I'm going to prove to you is that there is no set of distributions that can do this. So notice that all these relations parallel the relations that exist for the quantum operator. So the question is really, can I represent the convex structure of density operators in quantum theory in terms of probability distribution? And what I'm going to show you is that you can't. All right. So, given these three relations, I know that each one of these pairs has to be zero. So, let's take a particular value of lambda. At that value of lambda, either mu a of lambda or mu big a of lambda has to be zero. Otherwise, it couldn't happen. And one of these two guys will have to be zero. And one of these two will have to be zero. So start with the case where it's these two are zero. Okay? Now, plug that into this equation here. If these three guys are zero, then mu at that value of lambda is also zero. But now, if you look at this equation, this is zero, so mu big A has to be zero as well. And similarly here, mu big B has to be zero, mu big C has to be zero, so everything's zero. At that value of lambda, all seven of these distributions would have to have a value of zero. Okay, so that's not such a great choice. What's an alternative choice? I could say maybe this guy's zero, this guy's zero, and now mu big C is zero instead of mu little c. So let's consider that possibility. Plug these into this formula here again. So this one's zero. That tells me that mu has to be a third mu little c. That's what I've written here. And now mu big C is zero, so if I plug that in here, that tells me that nu has to be a half mu little c. But those two equations together tell me that mu little c has to be zero. That's the only way they can be satisfied. And now I'm back to little a, little b, and little c all being zero. I'm back to this case, so everything's zero. Is that clear? So if you think about those two cases I looked at, they correspond to this one, and this one being zero, or this one, and this one. And it turns out that every other possibility, by symmetry, is just a rotation of those guys, and it's going to look exactly the same, all the logic will carry through. And so, for every possible assignment of zeros to these guys, I end up with all the distributions being zero. And so at every value of lambda, every one of these mu of lambda has to be zero. But then they're not normalized to one. The probability distributions that when I integrate over all lambda, they're one. So here, if I integrate over lambda, I'm going to get zero. So I have a contradiction. No. So what this shows you is that you can't have what I call preparation non-contextuality, even in two-dimensional limits. So questions about it? Yeah.
You say you maybe you explain.
Well, I can always find a two-dimensional subspace in any three-dimensional total space. In that subspace, I can construct this point, and therefore, I can't move for three-dimensional system length. I will probably be able to construct other examples that sort of rely inherently on three-dimensionality. I haven't done so here, but I'm confident that probably this is but once you've shown a three-dimensional ID, then it follows its true form. So the old result, remember, you could find an environment theory for 2D, but not 3D or anything rare. Here, this shows that even in 2D, which is the only non-trivial case, you can't do it. You can't have preparation like that at all. Okay. Well, yeah, I'm examining whether I can explain all this stuff in terms of properties of the system.
Right.
That's right.
Now, that was the problem that the central plan was the time of preparation. I mean, food, the environment, and the threatening, or anywhere. If so, it felt that it doesn't have that description.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So now, what about the confusion approach perspective? So we just assume that no matter what equipment you use, no matter what operation you do, the set of variables is the same. Now it might be, well, here's a different preparation. Maybe this preparation has some extra variables in the equipment, just to kind of use it. Well, then you can just append that, so you just... Well, so I'm not sure if it's effective to append that to the same plans. It seems to be...
I think if you want to talk about contextuality, you have to say, here's a system, I'm interested in this system. If you start saying, let's incorporate part of the measurement device, then all of a sudden what counts as contextuality changes.
Right.
Because previously, you know, if the color of magnets was important, I would have said, well, you know, the properties of the system, the spin half particle, are not enough on their own. You also need the color of magnets. But if you incorporate all the paint into the system, and maybe everything that you left out, you know, you don't need. And so then you say, oh, it's non-contextual. You know, I've incorporated color paint into the system, and everything's non-contextual now.
So here, you know, that question you're mostly going to start, because you're usually defining non-contextuality. You're defining non-contextuality with two equivalent preparations, equivalent perspective of the measurements. They have the same distribution. So I don't think that's a perfect. So you're saying you're defining them in such a way that the paint between the
middle. Then what will better be about the possible sort of building
experience for that kind of robust case?
My sense is that there is a difference between personality and textuality, which is and I thought that the text would be needing a notion of system. Something that's actually just very important. Maybe you're right, maybe it's a system, but I don't
know. Well, I think from here, the system, when it comes to what's considered safe, right? You have to restrict your attention to the density matrix, but the system. Yeah. But the hidden variable just like this is used. The hidden variable is the density.
I'll show you the proof of measuring the neutrality, and I think
that'll help. If you have a different color up, then the hidden variable won't be the standard to include the system in it. I mean, so if you allow yourself the hidden variable to subtract one of them as well, then certainly it won't be the
same.
So won't that automatically be contextual on your side? I mean, you just get a trivial property.
Yeah, maybe that's true. If you incorporate too much, then you'll find contextuality every time. If your distribution, if your indirects incorporate so much, the trivial features of your procedures don't have any operational effects. It will give you orthogonal distributions, so you find contextuality. And then we get back to the point, because it seems like contextuality. Then you have contextuality that does depend on the system.
That's not my problem, because you have a probability distribution that depends on the invariant of the other way around. So if you have features of the system that don't depend on some part of the invariant, that's fine.
Okay, so I'm really running out of time, but I do want to show you the proof for unsharp measurements. So again, proving contextuality means that an unsharp measurement, non-contextual ontological model, is not possible. So remember, unsharp measurements were to do again. Again, this can work. So a few preliminaries before getting into proof. Here's an extra assumption. Outcome determinism for a measurement corresponds to the case where the functions that represent that measurement are either 1 or 0. Right? So this is the stuff I talked about at the very beginning. The assumption was that deterministic invariable theories, that measurements were always of this sort. But that's an additional assumption relative to the more general framework. And so a traditional notion of non-contextuality is basically what I call non-contextuality for sharp measurements, plus this additional assumption, which is that when you do a sharp measurement, the outcome of that measurement should actually be determined by the value of the invariant. These guys only have values 0 and 1. So notice that relative to the traditional notion, just my generalization, change is actually what it is that ought to depend on context or not. So in the traditional notion, you ask whether the outcome of measurement depends on how you did that measurement. But here I'm asking, do the probabilities of outcomes depend on how you did that measurement? And I think this is the right question to ask, especially if you're looking at stochastic invariable theories. Then you don't want to ask, do the outcomes depend on how you did the measurement? Because sometimes the outcomes aren't determined by everything, by the whole, by the invariable itself. Sometimes it's only probability that determines. So these are the things we have to look at. So really what's going on here, by generalizing the notion of non-contextuality, I've been able to separate the notion of non-contextuality from the notion of outcome determinism. And I think that's good. It's similar to what happened when Bell tried to formulate a notion of locality that allowed for stochastic invariable theories. So then you start talking about whether the probabilities of outcomes here can be determined by everything in the background like or not. And so Bell was able to say, there's a notion of locality and there's a notion of determinism, and they're not the same. So that's essentially what I'm trying to do here. Separate.
So you say you don't need this assumption to be
proved. It turns out that I'm going to, so you can make this assumption for sharp measurements, for unsharp measurements, for whatever measurements you want. So you might have thought, if you thought that this was part and parcel of non-contextuality, you might have asked, can I assume this for unsharp measurements? Do I get a contradiction? And if you do, you get a trivial contradiction. So my argument is actually, it's wrong to assume this for unsharp measurements, but it's right to assume it for sharp measurements. And the reason it's right is because I actually can prove that if you grant me preparation non-contextuality, then it follows that sharp measurements should be outcome deterministic. So that's again a subtlety, but the big picture is that I'm going to make the standard assumption with respect to sharp measurements that they're outcome deterministic, but for the POVM measurements, I'm not going to assume that, which I think is a natural assumption because POVM measurements represent noisy measurements, so I might expect that in those cases, the properties of the system alone is not enough to determine the outcome. So that's just what I told you. So what it means is that all the traditional proofs which assume outcome determinism for sharp measures are still no-go theorems for the idea that everything's on the textual preparation of measurements. Okay, so here's the proof. I start with just three measurements. There is the Z-spin, the spin along 60 degrees, spin along 120. By definition, these projective value measures have the following features. If I sum two orthogonal ones, I get identity. And these two projectors are orthogonal. In the ontological model, I have to represent these guys by some indicator functions. I know that indicator functions always sum up to one. That's just by definition. And now here's where I make my assumption of outcomes being determined by the value of the invariables, which says that at every value of lambda, either this guy or this guy has to be 0, and the other has to be 1. And so at every value of lambda, the product has to be 0. And so for each one of these pairs, at every value of lambda, either this guy is 0, this guy is 1, or vice versa. This guy is 1, this guy is 0. For each one of these pairs. That's going to be important. Alright. Now, I introduced a new measurement. This is my fourth measurement I have to consider, which is just roll your dice that generates three integers with probability of 30 each and decide whether to do these three measurements based on that outcome. And then put it all in a box, and the output of this measurement is just going to be whether you get the first or the second outcome. And it's not going to tell you which of the three measurements was made. So earlier I described this as a convex combination of those two measurements. Here's how you represent that in the quantum formalism. Suppose you kept the information about which measurement was made, then you would have said, well, with probability a third, I'm measuring EA, so I would have had commas everywhere here. There'd be six outcomes. Three possible measurements I made, and two possible outcomes for each measurement, and the probability would have been a third PA, a third PB, and so forth. But now I'm not keeping track of which measurement I made, so I have to coarse grain. So I just have to sum the probabilities for all three of these guys. So now it's again just a measurement that has two outcomes, and these are the two positive operators that associated with each outcome. In the invariable theory, I have to now take whatever characteristic functions were associated with each of those projectors and do the convex sum of them. That's how I represent the same measurement. And now, the critical thing here is that if you add up these three projectors, you get identity over two. So this measurement here is actually trivial. It corresponds to this P of M. So this P of M, if you think about it, for any density operator beforehand, if I ask what's the probability of getting the first outcome, the answer is trace row identity over 2. This is just a half, because trace row normalized is just a half. So the two outcomes have equal probability regardless of what I do beforehand. It doesn't matter what the preparation procedure is, it's just a random outcome. And so there's a different measurement procedure, which is equivalent, operationally equivalent to this one, and that's forget all about the system and just flip a coin. Fair point. That's also going to generate an outcome, the probability half for two possibilities. So it's equivalent. Now, how could I represent this in the hidden variable theory? Well, in terms of functions over lambda, for every value of lambda, it should just be a half a half. Because no matter what the state of the system is, my coin flip is going to come out a half a half. I'm just ignoring the system, I'm not measuring it at all. So these are just uniform distributions over lambda with height half each. So because these two measurements are considered equivalent, right, they're represented by the same POVM, that tells me that if I want a measurement non-contextual model, the representations of the hidden variable theory should also be equivalent. So that means this pair of indicator functions should just be equal to half each. So I've written that this way, this pair. Alright, now remember from the last slide, I told you that because of outcome determinism, this would always be 0, 1, or 1, 0 for each of these pairs. Okay, so if you plug that into the left hand side of what we had, suppose that it was 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, then I get 0, 1, that's not a half a half. It could be 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, and that would give me a third, two thirds, and that's not a half a half. And so on. If I have a single zero here, two zeros over there, I get this, or if I have all the zeros here, I get that. In every case, I don't have a half a half. so I get my contradiction. That tells me that non-contextuality for unsharp measurements is impossible. Okay. And I'm going to show you the proof of transformation of potentiality. It's basically the same idea. And use the different decompositions. So this is what I've done. Generalized the notion of contextuality to operational theories, different experimental procedures, indeterminism of cosmological models. You can find proofs for all three kinds of procedures, even in a 2D Hilbert space, proofs of contextuality. What does this teach us? Well, for one, these results, regardless of what you might think, don't provide support, additional support, for the idea that the quantum state is a complete description of reality. So this is something that is this sort of common wisdom, that these little theorems for hidden variables, well, they show us that the quantum state has to be a complete description of reality. It can't be, you know, that there's something else that we're missing. The reason that I think there's this impression is that Bell's theorem was derived in the context of hidden variable theory. So people say things like, oh, but if you're going to try to go for a hidden variable theory, if you're going to entertain the idea that the quantum state is an incomplete description, well, then you have non-locality, you have contextuality, and that's ugly. So quantum state has to be a complete description. But whether the quantum state is a complete description or not, Bell's theorem shows that quantum theory is non-local. Even if the quantum state's a complete description of reality, you actually don't even need Bell's theorem. The EPR argument is enough to show you that quantum theory is non-local. So it's not as if you're forced to deal with non-locality if you think the quantum state is incomplete. Regardless of whether you think the quantum state is complete or not, you're forced to deal with non-locality. So non-locality is just irrelevant to the issue of completeness. You have to deal with it either way. Now, the results I showed you in first half on preparation contextuality basically show you that whether the quantum state is complete or not, quantum theory is contextual in the sense that I define. So again, people say, oh, I don't like variable theories because they're contextual. You say, well, you know, even if you want to think that the quantum state's a complete description, you're going to have to deal with contextuality. So the issue of contextuality is not going to settle the issue of whether the quantum state is a complete description or not. All right. Another question we might ask is contextuality a mysterious phenomenon? Why don't we just say, well, yeah, okay, it's like that, that's not so surprising. It's not mysterious at all. And some people have said that. You know, Bell, for one, was surprised by non-locality, but he thought contextuality was okay, not a big deal. I happen to think contextuality is mysterious, and let me give you just a couple of reasons for why I think that's the case. The first reason is that if you think about consecutive measurements in time, then we have this feature in quantum mechanics that if I do some sharp measurement, objective value measurement, and then I repeat it immediately afterwards, I get exactly the same output over again. Contextuality tells me that if you want to think of that in terms of a hidden variable theory, that the first outcome of that measurement, I have my two tripods I told you about originally. So let's say I do this measurement, I get this outcome. And then I follow it by this measurement. I'm going to get that outcome again. And quantum theory tells me that. And with certainty, I'll get this outcome. If I do this measurement, I get this outcome, and I follow up that outcome. But the hidden variable picture says that the characteristic function associated with this guy is different in the two cases. So why is it that when I did my first measurement, and I found, you know, that definitely the hidden variables are in this region of my space, and then I followed that up by a second measurement, which corresponded to some necessarily different region, I got exactly the same outcome. I mean, couldn't it be that, you know, this is some region here, where this guy's non-zero, this guy's zero? Why wasn't it that the hidden variables were played here, and then when I did my next measurement, I got the opposite outcome? There has to be an explanation of this fact. You can explain this fact. You can say, well, what happens after this measurement is that the hidden variables get reshuffled and get pushed out of this region here into some region that lies in the intersection of all these guys. You can do that. But it complicates the explanation relative to the kind of explanation you would have had in a non-contextual theory.
I understand what I was saying earlier, the hidden variables could be in the space itself.
Yeah.
And how is that true in that case?
Well, and so in that case, that's an instance that's a subtle case. In the case where you imagine that the quantum state is all there is, you don't have what I call the outcome determinant. So you don't represent even your sharp measurements by flat characteristic functions. You have to represent them by distributions over the projectability space that are flat. They're only one at a single point. So it turns out that in that case, you don't get contradiction because you don't have outcome determinant. I needed outcome determinant. Those sorts of theories are preparation contextual. So I can still have a contradiction in preparation contextual that can have assumption. But you do explain the reproducibility by the fact that after I do a measurement of this, everything, the hidden variable gets pushed to this definitely at this point. So you can provide explanations for these. I'm not saying you can't, but it's interesting that those explanations have to be more complicated than you might have expected. And by the way, this also is relevant to the question whether it could be sensitive to hidden, the outcome could be sensitive to hidden variables in the apparatus. So let's say you're doing a measurement of Z spin, and then you're going to follow it up by another measurement of Z spin at Alpha Centauri. So you send the particle off to Alpha Centauri. If the original outcome depended not only on the properties of the particle, but the properties in your magnets, then why is it when I do that experiment at Alpha Centauri, if all I transmitted to Alpha Centauri is the particle, not your earlier device, why do I get the same outcome over there? How did it know what the properties of the device were if it's sensitive to the properties of the device? Again, explanations are possible. I just think that's complicated. And then the other reason I think it's mysterious is that there's a tension between two facts. What contextuality tells me is that the way I represent procedures depend on certain details of procedures. And yet, the statistics of outcomes don't depend on those details. That's the operational equivalence. So why is it that if things at the microscopic level do depend on these details, when I then average over my lack of knowledge, all of a sudden that dependence on those details disappears? Why is that? It seems to me that's the sort of thing that you need to provide an explanation for. And I'd like that explanation to be simple and helpful. And it's like the tension that exists for Bell's theorem. You might say, well, let's deal with Bell's theorem. It's not so bad. It's just non-classical. But the question, the tension is, if we have superluminal information transfer at the microscopic level, then why doesn't that appear at the macroscopic level? We have to explain that difference.
Well, yes, on your last slide, you might think it's whatever. It's kind of neither else that are not fixed in the arguments that this tension thing is not only the case that maybe it's even possible to have something is still narrative. Can this tension be an argument?
No, because so in the context of the theory where the quantum state is the full state of reality, it's still preparation textual. And yet it's a complete description of reality. So you still have this tension in that theory, even though the quantum state is descriptive of reality. I would say, I mean, that theory gives you a picture of why it is that...
It's preparation because there is an independence of the test.
That's true.
And preparation, it's there, it's on the surface, so it's so different.
Well, you're entitled to the opposite thing. So I'm thinking of an interpretation where you say every pure state is associated with no state of reality, and maybe also the mixed states that arise by reduction, partial trace, but the mixed states that arise by convex propagation, they actually are represented by distributions. And then in this case of like horizontal polarized probability half, vertical polarized probability half, left and right circular probability, so those are going to be represented by different distributions. So that's truly the appropriate.
But if you map that, you say it's actually just density, regardless of that. All right.
Then you have then I think you're violating one of these earlier assumptions about one flow at the moment. Because if I really do one preparation with probability p, and the other with probability 1 minus p, then you're telling me, well, that generates a whole new state of reality, rather than, you know, this distribution of quantum states with probability p and this distribution of probability 1 minus p. So you have to have some crazy views on how a convex combination affects the state of reality.
Well, it's not crazy, it's just like mathematics. But okay, I see what you mean.
Maybe I shouldn't use words crazy. I also a couple of other reasons to look at contextuality. If you look at certain toy theories that involve a restriction on how much you know, you find that things like non-commutativity and interference, features of entanglement can be reduced. See these references. So from my perspective, the mystery of these kinds of phenomena is lessened by recognizing that you can find things that are qualitatively similar to them, restricting your knowledge. And the fact that contextuality is missing in these views makes me focus on it. It's one of the mysteries that I don't really get. And so in my view, if you're going to try to come up with an axiomatic derivation of quantum theory in the context of an ontological model, then probably you need to have an axiom that says your knowledge is fundamentally restricted, and you'll need a couple of other axioms. And I think contextuality is a good clue for trying to figure out what those other axioms are going to be. And then finally, I'm also interested because I think it might have applications to quantum information theory. So it turns out that a lot of quantum information processing tasks like key distribution, dense coding, and so forth actually do exist in other theories that are local and non-contextual. So they really have nothing to do with distribution of quantum mechanics. But there are certain tasks like communication complexity problems that actually require the Bell correlations. So they are connected to non-locality. And the question becomes, are there any quantum information tasks that rely on contextuality for their advantage over classical information processing? And so Ernesto, in his thesis, talked a bit about the connection between contextuality and random access codes. And then I think an interesting speculation is whether maybe quantum computation somehow is making use of the contextuality of quantum theory to improve, to offer a speed up relative to classical computation, if such a speed up exists. So,
I have one, and I think it's a very short one. So, are you in a filter to give a sort of axiomatic definition of the equivalence classes? If you have this free sense about the duration of transformations and measurements, and you wrote down the definition of observational operational equivalences. So, is it known? It sounds like a side question. The actual quantum mechanics power that you're focused on is checking on these equivalence classes?
That's a good question.
This is just a kind of question. And if there are more, so is it known that these equivalence classes are maximal with respect to your testing equivalence?
Okay, so there's the question from the theoretical perspective and from the experimental perspective. So you want it from the theoretical perspective.
Yeah.
So it is true that if you consider the most general set of